introducing tonight's speaker, I would like to invite those of you who have not already done so to consider joining the Institute. The Institute is a voluntary organization which is vitally dependent on the financial support of its members. Membership fees are modest and they are tax deductible. Turning now to the subject of this evening. Professor Gregor Kixalis is a professor in the Department of Computer Science at UBC, and he also maintains a research association in the software design area of Xerox PARC in Palo Alto, California. The focus of Professor Kixalis' research is techniques for designing and implementing software systems that are highly flexible, maintainable, reusable, tailorable, and reconfigurable. And he is interested in design principles for making software that is open, in the sense that it allows the clients to examine and control certain crucial aspects of the implementation of the system. Professor Kixalis' topic tonight is an intriguing one: programming, poetry, gears, or magic. Professor Kixalis.
Thank you. Thank you. What I want to talk about is programming and programming languages. It's normally a pretty esoteric topic, not one that people would gather around on a Saturday evening to listen to. But I want to try to share with you some of why I think programming is so interesting, some of why I think programming language research is so interesting, and some of where it may be going. So what I want to do is I'm going to try to use the demands of current software systems, so the kinds of software that you may use today, either on a PC or when you go to the bank or something like that. I'm going to use the demands of current software systems to look at four generations of software research, three past generations and one generation that we're sort of in the midst of right now. And I'll try to talk about the problems that each generation addressed, what was sort of the core idea that was going on there, and what we learned from that about building programs. Now, I'm going to put some actually fairly real code up on the screen. Let me just, for my own sense, how many people here would describe themselves as you know, being able to program? Okay. Well, I was assuming that all real programmers would be at work at Saturday night at 8 o'clock. So I've cut a few corners in my examples. I hope you'll forgive me. For those of you who would not describe yourself as programmers, don't worry. I'm going to walk you through this code. I think you'll be able to get enough of the sense of it to understand what these ideas are about. The code is sort of idealized but substantive, so don't worry about that. So here's some of the themes I want to try to explore. For people who don't know what software is, what code is, what it means when somebody says lines of code, I'm going to try to give you a sense of that. Try to give you a sense, again, of why I think programming is so interesting, maybe why software breaks so much. For people who are programmers but maybe not familiar with programming language research, give you a sense of sort of what are the questions in programming language research, what are the kinds of things we try to think about, where might that field be going, what might new innovations in programming language research be. And one thing I want to kind of give you a sense of is what it might mean for a program to be beautiful or elegant is a word that we tend to use more often. This, at the bottom here is, where's my lightsaber? Battery's a little low. This is a one of the candidate replacements for the Bay Bridge down in San Francisco. And I think all of us, even if we're not structural engineers, can kind of look at this and have a discussion about whether that's pretty or not. And I'd like to try to give you some sense of what it would mean to have a similar discussion about whether a program's pretty or not. So in some sense, sort of the technical and aesthetic underpinnings of programming language research. Now, I will be talking about bridges and engineering and aesthetics. I won't be talking about the aesthetics of this kind of bridge engineering. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle. Okay, so what do I mean when I say current applications? Well, here's the email tool that I use for reading email. It's got another picture of a bridge here. This is the current Bay Bridge. And for people who are familiar with these applications, you're probably familiar with how this one works. There's some buttons up here that I can press to read my email. And I'll try to use this again. And messages here, and I can click on all of these things. And sort of just a familiar Windows desktop application. Here's another application, PowerPoint. This is the application I used to prepare the slides for this talk. This is a slide that we'll see later in the talk. Again, it's got lots of buttons that you can press on, and there's sort of a big area in the middle where you can see the slides. Here's an internet browser. More people may have used an internet browser. I'm at the Globe and Mail site here. So this is kind of what I mean by current applications, applications that maybe run on your Windows desktop or your friend's Windows desktop, something like that. Now, since some of the people here have never written a program before, it's too much to start out by trying to write one of these. So we'll start with something a little bit simpler. Here's a much simpler browser that we made just the other day. And it's just a simple browser that can show you some of these lovely prints. And it's got a choice of three. There's the whale, eagle, and a dogfish. So here's the eagle. And you could sort of switch back and forth between them and print it out or quit. So I think you'd agree that that's also a browser. It's a much, much simpler browser than the one just before. And in fact, even that's too complicated to start with. What we're really going to start with is a very simple program that just prints out the numbers 1, 2, 3. The way you can think about this is that, in some sense, these programs scale up in, they scale up in size, that's true. They also scale up in complexity. I think that's a bit more interesting, but harder to measure. So here's our little program that prints 1, 2, 3, and our simple browser and desktop applications. And this is supposed to be the world that we're, I shouldn't even say moving to anymore because we're there, but the world of wireless, mobile, internet everywhere, embedded computing everywhere, ubiquitous computing, this is supposed to be that world, and it's supposed to be much more complex. So let's start with the program that prints 1, 2, 3. Now, this isn't just a joke, right? This is a substantive subpart of the browser. Because I think you can imagine that before you could make a menu, this is just not happening. Before you could make a menu that would have three choices, you maybe need to be able to do something simpler three times, like print out three numbers. So you'll see that this program of printing 1, 2, 3 wasn't randomly chosen. So what I want to do is I'm going to try to write this program, and I'm going to use 1964 technology to do it. Okay? So here we go. Here's a program that prints 1, 2, 3 in my idealized version of 1964 technology. Let me try to read you through it. What does it do? The first line it says is it says, well, I, over here, this is really going to be a bother. I is 1. And then it says, well, if I is less than 4, go to B. And I is definitely less than 4 because it's 1. And so go to B means go to here. That's what go to does. It says go to that thing. And then we're going to print I. Now, it's OK if you get confused about this program. I want you to get confused about this program because we're doing better now. Print 1 and then make I be 1 bigger than it already is. So that's 2. Now go to A. Now we're back at A. And we test I and we go to B, except sometimes we go to C. And this program is quite confusing. And one reason it's confusing is because it's really difficult to remember what A, B, and C mean. So after writing programs like that for a while, we learned how to make them slightly better by picking better names than A, B, and C. We started calling them names like this is the body of the program because it does the real printing. And then this is the test, which tests whether we're done. And if we're not done, we go to the body. And if we are done, we go to the end. So that program's a little bit easier to understand. But it's still kind of confusing because you can go to the body and you can go to the end and then you can go back up here and sometimes you do this and these paths all seem to cross each other. And after writing programs like that for a bit, there was a consensus that programs like this that had go-tos that crossed each other a lot, it's not just you. Everybody thought these programs were confusing. So we learned how to write them a little bit better. That program does the exact same thing. And it's nicer. One reason why it's nicer is it doesn't have these crossing go-tos. Right? It doesn't have that nice little braid, which might look nice, but isn't. And it also uses a nice name. And this program, I'm going to read through this one a little bit more carefully, because I think this one is now understandable. You set I to be 1. You print I, so that's 1. You make I 1 bigger, that's 2. You ask if I is less than 4, and it is, because 2 is less than 4. And then you go back up here, and you print 2, and you go around 3 times, and you're done. So that program, as compared to the previous program, is something that we would consider elegant code. Now, elegant, you know, it's one of these aesthetic words, so it's very difficult to define precisely what elegant means. But one of the reasons why this is elegant is it's very concise, short, it's direct, it's to the point, it's nicely named. I also like this because its structure reflects the structure of what it's trying to do. It just has this one little loop instead of all those different go-tos. It's also idiomatic. That's quite important because in these kinds of languages where you had to program this way, you wanted to write code that other programmers could recognize easily. I'll talk more about that. So this is elegant code. How many people read, either of their own free will or otherwise, this book? Yeah, so this is a book about writing well. It's about writing forcefully and writing clearly. And a lot of the kinds of things that this book talks about are true of elegant code, too. It talks about writing concisely. It talks about not using more terms or words than you need, not using more go-tos than you need. We don't have a book like this, but in some sense, this word elegant that we use is trying to get at some of those properties. Now, after programming with like this for a while and learning how to write better code, we figured out that actually there were more bad things you could do with go-to than there were good things. And so the programming language researchers came in and they said, look, we'll just get rid of go-to. And instead we'll give you a couple of other ways to do loops, of which this is one called while. And I'll just read this to you. This while, notice that this little curly brace and this little curly brace there delineate what we call the body. And what this while says is it says, keep doing over and over and over as long as this is true, as long as I is less than 4. So this code doesn't even have an explicit go-to in it. And it's a bit easier to read for that reason. It's more idiomatic, because it says it's a while loop right there on the front. That's kind of nice. One way of thinking about this is that programming language designers, this is why our job is fun. We make up the rules. We actually get to invent the vocabulary and the grammar. We decided that go-to wasn't something that people should say, so we took it away from them. One way of thinking about programming language researchers is we're kind of like your sixth grade grammar teacher with an attitude. Because whereas your sixth grade grammar teacher can say, I don't want to hear you use that word, we can say, from now on, that word will have no meaning, which is a good way of getting people not to use it. So in some sense, what we thought we were doing was we were saying, well, you will write elegant code because I will give you constructs that can only be used to write elegant code. Well, needless to say, they can actually be also be used to write bad code. But it was a bit better. Let me get back to that. So this sort of period of debate in the field in which we basically eliminated GoTo and replaced it with things like while is sort of a debate that ended up being called structured programming. It lasted from the late 60s to about mid-70s. One of the first and most famous papers was this one, which was GoTo considered harmful. And then a few years later, Bill Wolf said, yes, GoTo really is harmful. And then Don Knuth said, I can actually write good code with GoTo. And then everybody else said, yes, but you're brilliant. The rest of us can't write good code with GoTo. Or we can, but it's hard. So in this intervening period, we ended up getting rid of GoTo and replacing it with these other constructs. Later on, this guy wrote this letter to the editor of CACM, which at the time was sort of a premier journal in the field. And he asserted that GoTo-less programming has cost businesses hundreds of millions of dollars, which back then was real money. And the response to this letter to the editor was more than any other issue, any other letter to the editor in CACM. Most of the responses were of the form, look, here's a better way to write that code you wrote. So during this debate, many principles of the field were forged. And I think we got to get some sense of what it was to be a programming language researcher, what our job was. And our job was to try to help people write more elegant code. So this kind of settled down in about the mid-70s, but as this citation shows, it's not completely settled down. Take this example. These two programs both print 1, 2, 3. I will soon get to a more sophisticated program, don't worry. These two programs both print 1, 2, 3, and they both use while, but they're written a slightly different way. This one says, keep doing this over and over and over as long as I is less than 4. And this one says, keep doing this over and over and over as long as I is not 4. So they do the same thing. You can get two programmers to fight and fight and fight over which of these is better. And I think that's actually important because what it reflects is that these people are trying to write in an elegant way what they're trying to do. And whenever somebody in a creative process tries to write, they're going to be willing to fight over what's the right word to use in this sentence, especially if they spend a lot of time doing it. So this is a way that programmers can fight. This slide is about a way that programming language researchers can still fight about this very topic. By fight, I mean have a vigorous and healthy debate. So here's a slightly different construct. This is called do until. It's a version of do until. And what this says is do the body, the part between those two brackets, over and over and over until I equals 3. And because it does the test at the end of the loop rather than the beginning of the loop, you can write the test you actually want to write, which is to say, quit when you get to 3, instead of saying, quit if you've gotten to 4. So you could add this construct to languages, and then programmers could write this little tiny loop this same way. Pretty much we've decided not, most languages haven't added this. They've added while. Here's another kind of loop. This is much more general purpose. I'm not going to talk you through it. The reason that's interesting is because it's about as general purpose as you can get without giving people go-to. Because it still has this sort of block-structured body. There's still a clear sense as to what the body of the loop is. But you can use more variables and stuff. I won't go into that other than to say that essentially all languages have added this because it's about as general as you can get without go-to. And that's kind of part of the game that programming language designers play, is we want to give you some general power, but maybe not too much. Here's one final possibility. Thank you. This is a very explicit construct which is designed, it just says, do something three times and let I be the count. This is the easiest one to read so far. It's also the most special purpose one. This won't do anything other than do something n times. Most languages have not added this because language designers deemed that it was too special purpose. We decided that if we started putting in things like this, there'd be dozens and dozens and dozens of them. I'm not sure that's right, but that's what most language designers have decided. So now, some of you may be sitting there thinking, why on earth could this possibly matter? Right? For people who've never seen a program or written a program before, you might be saying, he's talking about making programs easy to understand, but I didn't think the computer could get confused. And it can't. I'm not talking about making them easy to understand for the computers, because they're real good at understanding real convoluted things. Even for people who write programs occasionally, you might say, you know, it just doesn't matter this much for programs to be easy to understand. And actually, it turns out it does, and here's why. It's a reasonably safe estimate to say that most organizations spend in the neighborhood of 10 times as much maintaining programs that they've already written than they spend writing programs in the first place. And the reason that happens is that programs always change. They always change. One way they change is that you thought there were no bugs left and they turned out there were. So somebody's got to go back and fix that. Another way they change is you add new functionality or the world around the program changes. So for example, you know, there's all these companies now that are busy integrating their MIS systems with all these new customers who want to talk to the MIS systems over the internet and the web. And you can believe that when those MIS systems were first designed, they weren't designed with web access in them. So people are having to go back and change those programs in some way. So programs always change, and that means that programs have to be readable by other people. In a sense, they sort of have to tell a story, and it has to be a coherent story. Somebody's got to be able to walk up to this program and sit down and start reading and quickly see what the key points are and understand what's going on so that they can figure out, gee, if I'm going to change this story, how do I change it? So in some sense, that's what elegance in programs is about. It's about making programs so that the next person can come along and understand them. And I think now you can start to get a bit of a sense of what I was talking about in my title in terms of programs being sometimes like gears and sometimes like poetry, right? Because that little loop, you know, feels very chunk, chunk, chunk. It's got to kind of go through its thing and count and print and chunk, 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 kind of like gears do. But because programs are also literary in a sense, right, they're written for other people to understand, and because they're written in this sort of very stylized way, in that sense they sometimes feel to me like poetry, sometimes nicer than other times. I'll talk more about that as we go. So that ends the first generation of programming language research I was going to talk about. The peak of this was 64 to 75, and the basic idea was we're going to get rid of GoTo, and we're going to replace it with more abstract mechanisms. I showed you while, and I briefly showed you do. Another thing we did was to improve if-then-else. You might remember in that first code I showed you, there was if, and then there was a GoTo, and then there was another GoTo. We basically did the same trick with if, then, else, which is we put these curly braces in here so that you could put a block there and you didn't have to use go to in order to use if. It's the same idea. And the result of this was that programs were easier to understand, easier to read, easier to modify. I'm going to use throughout this talk a metric, which is, it's an imperfect metric, but it's just to give you kind of a rough idea. The result of structured programming, one way of thinking about it, is that 100 programs written, 100 lines of code written using structured programming felt maybe about as complicated as 10 lines of code written without it. Because those go-tos really were complicated, where with these blocks, it was a bit easier to understand what was going on. And another reason it was simpler is because there was a kind of abstraction going on. Because when you read a program with a while loop, you can internalize that as a while loop. You don't have to look at all the detail of the go-tos. So that was an important thing. Okay, so now let's make a slightly more complicated program. Remember, it's this simple browser, and it's got a little three-choice menu here. I can click on any of these, or I could turn it off, and then there'll be no image at all. And I can print it, or I can quit. So now what we're going to do is we're going to try to implement this with structured programming. So roughly speaking, 1975 technology. So there'll be no go-tos. We're going to use nice, explicit constructs. Okay, so here's the code. I'm going to show you again a kind of simplified, idealized implementation of it. So what does this say? It says, well, the first thing I have to do is label myself that I'm this browser. And I'm going to put up this menu that gives you choices between whale, eagle, and dogfish. And I made this simpler. I took print out. I've just got quit. So I'll put up that menu. And then I'm going to use while again. You're going to see it all day. While. I'm going to loop around here, checking to see if any of the buttons have changed. And if the buttons have changed, I'll change the image. Now, in order to really understand this code, these are procedure calls. What those do is they go off to some other code. So to really understand it, you've got to go look at that other code. So what drawLabel does is it comes down here, and it calculates the width, and it prints out the string, and then it's got to do some stuff having to do with x and y coordinates. And you can kind of read that. You don't have to read this code in a detailed sense, okay? What I'm saying about it is all the detail you need to know about it. And then what happens? Oh, we go back up, and then we call radio menu. And radio menu comes down here, and it's got a while loop because it's got to print out all the different buttons. And it calls radio button. And here's radio button, and radio button calls draw circle. And draw circle calls this thing, and that's primitive, so we won't follow that right now. But we come back here, and then we got to call draw label. It's getting less simple. And then we go back up here, and we call over here to button menu. And button menu calls draw label too, and it's definitely getting less simple. And now what happens? I'm confused myself. I'll just press the button and see what happens. Oh. Now we call check buttons. You know, we're going to maybe have to switch machines. Now we call check buttons, and I don't even have room on the screen for check buttons. And then we'll call draw image, and here's draw image, and it does whatever it does. And it's really not so simple anymore. And in fact, it's much worse than this, because there's a whole bunch of other ones that I didn't even have room for that I didn't show you. So what's happening here is structured programming did a wonderful thing for us, which is it said kind of down at the micro level, you're going to understand how the program goes from one line of code to the next line of code real well. But when you get a bigger program, there's so much going on, you get overwhelmed again. Now, what happened after we wrote a bunch of programs like this for a while is we started to figure out that maybe you could think about them in a different way. And in particular, if you stop focusing on the order in which things happened, and you started focusing on kind of what the code was about, you could realize that, well, this is really the main part of the program, and all of this has to do with menus. The radio menu, the radio button. And all of this kind of has to do with drawing things on the screen. And when you started to think about your program that way, what you could do is just reorganize it. We're not going to change the language here at all. You just reorganize the program like this. And now you've got everything having to do with drawing in one place, and everything having to do with menus in one place, and the main programs in another place. And this kind of program was much easier to understand. And much easier to work with, for a reason I'll talk about in a minute. Now, the question was, where were you going to draw these boxes, right? This idea of separating the program into different concerns seemed pretty good. Well, how were we going to do that? So there was a lot of work on sort of the principles for doing that, how you were going to group things. Dave Parnas, who's at McMaster now and was really one of the leaders in this area, said, well, you should group the program according to shared secrets. And there was a great deal of sense of what might he mean by shared secrets. And he talked about it some, but we didn't really quite understand what he meant by shared secrets. I believe that history will show that we would have saved time if we had understood what he meant by shared secrets, because I think he was onto something. Instead, most people group their program according to sort of common functionality. And I think we've come back to understanding more what shared secrets meant. But the idea was that the menu stuff was here and the graphic stuff was here. And another principle was to try to organize it so that the arrows sort of all flowed generally towards the bottom as opposed to flowing back up. And what that led to was we talked about these things being modules and them having crisp, narrow interfaces. Again, these wonderful aesthetic words that are difficult to define. But in some sense, notice what I've done here in this picture. I've left the full code here. But for the menu part and the graphics part, I've just started showing the names of the procedures. I didn't show the whole rest of it. And that's because from over here, all you need to know is the names of those things. And that's kind of what we meant by narrow interfaces, was that there would only be a few things you had to know when you were standing over here about over here. So people started to figure out how to write code like this, and programming language researchers started to figure out how to help. And the way that we figured out to help was to help people with these narrow interfaces. We came up with mechanisms like this one here that would allow people to say, look, here's the menus module, and here's its interface. And then what the programming language would do was it would make sure that nobody would ever cheat, that nobody would ever try to reach inside of the menus module and touch something they weren't supposed to touch. Now, it's not that programmers are by nature cheatful. It's that most code is written 5 weeks late and 4 o'clock in the morning. And under those circumstances, it's easy to forget what you're not supposed to touch. And so this was really very important because this kind of research let programmers say, look, here's my module interface, and I can be sure that nobody's gonna come in a way that they shouldn't. So there was research in what we call type systems and opacity for dealing with some of these issues. A lot of programming language researchers tended to call stuff like this abstraction mechanisms. And let me see if I can say why we called it that. Again, it's this notion that from outside the module, all you could see was the interface of the module. And this was really extremely important. Because when the program starts to scale up in size, if you can be sure that nobody violates the interfaces, then you can start thinking architecturally about the program. You could say, well, here's my program. And you can start zooming in on one part of the program at one level of detail, or another part of the program at another level of detail. Now, in this little three-module system, that's no big deal. But in a 100-module system, this was a very big deal, because it meant that you could think of the system as, well, there's 99 boxes about which I just have to know four or five things, and then there's my box about which I have to know a lot. So what was going on here was sort of abstraction at one level up. So because the programming language was letting us operate in terms of this modular programming idea and be sure that it was going to work that way, we could reason about the system in these high-level ways. Again, I'm giving you this metric. As I said, I'm a little uncomfortable with these metrics, but they're just intended to sort of give you the flavor of it. The benefit of modular programming was that you could treat a system of 100 modules, and in your head, that would be like thinking about just 1,000 lines of the previous kind of code, whereas the code for 100 modules might be more like 10,000 lines. So this was another big deal. It significantly advanced our ability to build complicated programs. Okay, part three. We counted to three, we built a simple browser. Now I want to talk about what it takes to build these kinds of applications that run on your PC today. I call them current applications at the beginning of the talk, but really, and I don't mean this in a negative way at all, these are applications of about 10 years ago. We've known how to build these things pretty well now for quite some time. And I think the industry as a whole is moving into more sophisticated kinds of applications. But these are the kinds of applications I want to talk about now. Now, we're starting to get to a level of complexity where I can't give you the nice little simple example of the bad problem. I'll have to sort of motivate the bad problem for you, but I won't be able to sort of show it to you in as clear a way as I've been doing. You'll be the judge of clear. Let me just say in as explicit a way as I've been doing. But let me try to give you some sense of why we get into problems and the code starts to become a mess in these kinds of applications. And in order to do that, let's just focus on the top menu bar right here of PowerPoint. See all these little buttons up here? And let's just look at that. Technology is not my friend. There was a possibility that this machine was going to get unhappy. But since I'm smart enough, to never trust a computer. And since my very nice graduate students helped me set all this up, Should be okay. Okay, so let's look at just that one part of that program. Now, just 1 second. Do we believe that this goes in there now? Where's Chris? It should work too, right? Technology. Pardon? Okay. Oh, yeah. This one, we're two-thirds through, so we ought to be able to get to the end now. Okay, so look at just this top part of the PowerPoint application. Look at all these little buttons. These are called pull-down menus, and these things right here, you can't quite make them out, but they're called toolbars. So these have one kind of button on them, and these have another kind of button on them. This is a button called a combo text box and list. These are toolbar buttons and color choosers, and there's just a great variety of buttons here. And they're all very useful, too, for making these slides. Here's the thing. Modular programming doesn't quite so much help with this. And let me see if I give you a sense of why. One reason is that in a simple modularization, all of these buttons would be in the same module, the menu module. And so you'd be inside of your box, and you'd have to deal with this mess. Now, you could solve that problem by making submodules. So there'd be lots of different little submodules. But that doesn't deal with a very important thing that's going on here, which is it isn't just that there's lots of functionality here. It's that the functionality is related and varies in interesting ways. Right? You wouldn't want to make a separate module for every single one of these buttons, because they kind of all have some buttonness that ought to be somehow captured. So modular programming doesn't quite let you do that. So let me talk about the idea that does let you do that. And what's interesting about this idea is it was invented in 64. But it didn't really take off until the mid to late 80s. And I think in this case, we just have to ascribe that to these people being brilliant and seeing farther ahead the kinds of problems that you would run into with big systems. As I'll say in a minute, the technology ended up being called object-oriented programming. The first work was done in Norway by Dahl and Nygaard. Christian Nygaard has since then stayed in this community and is a senior member of the community and still a contributor. Much of the later work was done at Xerox PARC by Alan Kay's group on Smalltalk. There's a good little story about how that ended up happening. In Norway, they were using Simula to do simulations for nuclear reactors that they were designing. And Alan Kay was a graduate student at Utah. The computer science department was heavily funded by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. Utah is a state in the northern part of the country I come from. And let's just say that these guys in a suit one day showed up and said, here, this is the world's best Algol compiler. It comes from Norway. And asked some of the students there to figure it out. So Alan Kay prints this thing out and puts the paper up and down the hallways. And he studies it and studies it and studies it. And he's going, this may be the world's best Algol compiler, but it's also the world's weirdest Algol compiler, because I could square this language is not Algol. And the only reason that it seemed at all close was Simula was syntactically compatible in a lot of ways with Algol. And eventually he figured out that this was in fact not Algol, it was this new idea, which he then called object-oriented programming. The big idea in object-oriented programming was that abstraction wasn't enough. In order to deal with complicated systems, You also want to use concepts of classification and specialization. Let me see if I can talk about what that means. And their idea was that the world works in terms of classification and specialization and abstraction. And we can just take advantage of that. Christian has this great line he likes to say, which is whenever somebody says, you know, people have a hard time dealing with complexity, he says, and I can't imitate him, he's a big guy, he says, "No, not true. Have you ever flown through Heathrow? Did you get where you were going? You can deal with complexity." And there's something right about that. I mean, although it doesn't always seem like you'll get where you're going through Heathrow, but so let me talk about this idea, object-oriented programming. I need to pick up speed a bit. One of the central concepts is objects. And what objects are, this is an object here. This little menu is an object. And this little menu is also an object. And what objects are is that they're animate, in the sense that they know how to do things. Like these menus know how to draw themselves on the screen. Alan said that objects were like little computers waiting to be told to do something. And they're also classified in the sense that some objects are specializations of other objects, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So one concept was objects, another concept was class. And class is kind of a cookie cutter for objects. So let me show you how that works. Here's what we call a class hierarchy. Here's one kind of menu, a button menu. It's got those two little buttons on it. And here's another menu, the one we've seen. It's a radio button menu because if I press on whale, then eagle turns off and I switch to whale. And here's another kind of menu. This is the menu that you can use to put your one-year-old to bed at night. You just sort of check things off until you get to the end. This is called the checkbox menu. So those are all three kinds of menus. And then the idea of classification hierarchy is to notice, does this so well? These hierarchies are so powerful that, in fact, there are tools you can use where what you do is draw the picture and you get the code after, rather than the other way around. Because this hierarchy thing really does capture something about the programs, and that's quite nice. So what have I showed you so far? I've kind of showed you the same story three times. First, there was the raw machine thing with its go-tos. And when you programmed like that, it got to be a mess. It's a small mess, but I need room on the slide. It got to be a mess. But with structured programming, we got rid of the go-tos, and the code got to be better. But then you try to use structured programming to write that little browser, and you get another mess. But then we invented modular programming, which gave us a higher level of abstraction, and things got nice again. And then we tried to program complex systems in which there was not only a bunch of stuff, but also variation, and it got to be a mess, and I didn't even show you the mess. But object-oriented programming helps to clean it up. And these systems like Windows that have all of this functionality, Windows and Java, they all use object-oriented programming to capture that. Now, it turns out that if you look at big object-oriented programs, big complicated ones, or sometimes they don't even need to be that big. They just need to be used in certain kind of demanding ways. You also get a mess. Now, I couldn't show you this mess. I definitely can't show you this mess in the time I have. The question is, what's going to be here, right? If this same talk happens in 10 years, what's going to be here? Well, we don't know what's going to be here, because that's what the research we're doing now is. But I know what I hope is going to be here, because I hope the thing that I'm working on with my students is the thing that's going to be here. And they hope so, too, I think. So
do we.
Now, I think you'd be happy with any good solution, right? So let me tell you sort of the vision behind the idea that goes here. Instead of building bottom up, I'm going to build kind of top down. And I'm going to build kind of top down. Let me sort of tell you the vision behind this idea. Oops, not that keyboard. So I'm going to tell you the vision by analogy. This is another bridge. This bridge is made out of wooden blocks. It's a simpler bridge. So three little 2x4s or something right here. So if you think about designing and building that bridge, and you ask a mechanical engineer to think about it so that they sort of over-engineer it, they can draw you several different kinds of pictures or models of the bridge. This picture is a picture of the simple static forces in the bridge. These arrows on the bottom reflect the fact that the two posts are holding it up, and that arrow in the middle reflects the fact that gravity is pulling it down. Or they can draw you this picture, which is a more detailed version of the statics picture, and it reflects the fact that, in fact, gravity doesn't act in the middle. It acts all along the top. And this picture has an important property that this picture doesn't have, which is it reflects the varying shear force in the horizontal beam. And then they can draw you this picture. This picture isn't about the static forces in the bridge. It's about the dynamics in the bridge. Now, you might argue that two wooden blocks with one on top doesn't have much dynamics, but give me a little latitude. This is about the dynamics in the bridge. The interesting thing about this picture is that this is not a more detailed version of these other pictures. It's a fundamentally different picture. This picture carves up the bridge in a whole different way. Right? If you take this picture apart into pieces, you never find that one. And I was really struck by the fact that this discipline, which is an older discipline and a more mature discipline, has used their ability to draw different kinds of pictures to get at different kinds of issues. So now, what on earth might this have to do with programs? Well, let me suggest this to you. Talk about models and artifacts. This is a real artifact. This is a real bridge. And what I mean by real artifact is that if you take the 2x4s or the wooden blocks and you set them here, they do their thing, right? And this is a model, right? What I mean by abstract model is, I mean, it's an abstract model. It's not connected to the bridge in any way. So to me, the most magical property of programs, right, this is the one that still gets me, is that programs are both. It's really an amazing fact. Programs are abstract models in the sense that they are formal symbol systems. There are formal, rigorously defined notation for describing something. But they're also a lot like 2x4s because you can run them and they do their thing. Right? You don't have to read the program, go to Home Depot, buy the parts, put it together. You just run the program and it does their thing. Its thing. So programs live in this funny middle ground where they manage to have properties of both being an abstract model and properties of being real artifacts. So the question is, could you somehow find a way to have this magic property that programs have, which is that they're both models and artifacts, and also get the magic property that other kinds of models have, which is that they're cross-cutting. Right? See, you've seen me today show you programs that were more or less detailed. That's what this abstraction thing's all about, is more versus less detail. But the question is, what would a program be that was as different as that program, as those two pictures are, but still was about the same thing and connected up? So we've been thinking about that for about 10 years, and the good news is we've actually made some progress. Here at Xerox PARC, and a growing number of people around the world have made some progress. I'm just going to give you a quick sense of where we've gotten, and then I'll wrap up. We're calling this idea aspect-oriented programming. And it comes into play because of this issue of wanting more than one modularity. Remember the thing I said about when we went to modular programming, we said, well, let's ignore the order in which things happen, and we'll group things according to kind of what they're about. And that gave us those lovely boxes. The problem is sometimes the order in which things happen matters a lot. So this is a couple little modules from an operating system. This is the virtual memory part and the local file system part. And sometimes the things you want to program depend tremendously on the order in which things happen. In fact, if you look at this code, what you want to do is you want to say, well, if just this chain of events happens, then here's a special thing that should happen there. And if you use modular programming, it's a horrible mess because you've got to take this red and blue and spread it all over. What we've been able to do with aspect-oriented programming is to modularize the red, even though it cuts through, or cross-cuts is the word we use, the black. So we're able to write programs like these that cross-cut each other in very much the same way as those models cross-cut each other. Oop, I got to run this again. Sorry. So that's kind of my story about programming and programming language research. My sense is that what happens in every generation of this is that we push our current technology until it gets to be a mess. And then somebody, some group of people, some programming language researcher, usually just programmers, discovers a principle that can help us get structure. And then programming language researchers sort of capture that in the language, and code gets better and better. It's my hope that the right version of this picture 10 years from now is going to end with cross-cutting aspects, which is the thing we're working on. But there are other proposals. What's clear is that this technology, objects plus modules, is starting to run out of steam again, and we do need to do something new. Thanks a lot for your time. So do we take questions?
Questions.
With all these advances in programming technology, how come your operating system still has stops halfway through the lecture?
You know, I'm just... first I'll point out, it's not my operating system.
Not my choice either.
You know, there's any number of joke answers you can give to that, but I actually think I've given you a pretty good framework for the answer. Okay? Look what happens. Remember I said that what's good about object-oriented programming is you only have to say something once because you can inherit it. Well, aspect-oriented programming is about the same thing, right? If you don't have aspect-oriented programming, you tend to have to scatter your stuff to and fro. And I think that bad modularity is really one of the basic reasons why programs fail. And here's why. Remember, they change all the time. The line I like to use is, you know, you figure something out and you realize it needs to be put in 12 different places, and you do it. And a year later, somebody else is working on the code, and because they're really, really good and they make a lot of money, they find 11 of them. That's one of the basic reasons why software crashes. Do you call on them or do I?
You go ahead.
What inspired you to
work here? I was supposed to repeat the question. He's wondering why I would spend my days doing this. But you put it in a much better way about why I would make a career out of doing this. You know, I just like it. It's just very interesting, and I know how to do it. I never had a great answer to that question. I started out when I went to college as a mechanical engineer, and then I took this, and it was just pretty cool. Next. Yeah. So the question is, if you look at students completing grade 12 in 10 years, how will this affect what they're learning? Students taking social studies, how will this affect what they're learning? You know, I don't know, actually. I think one of the interesting things that's happening in computer science is that as computing becomes more and more ubiquitous, many of the interesting questions are not the sort of old-style computer science, heart of the machine, but are questions about, you know, how does ubiquitous computing interface with social practice and issues of privacy and just tons of really fascinating stuff there. And I'm in a funny situation because I actually think that stuff is really, really important. And it's what you know, research groups in our field should be putting resources into. At Xerox PARC, it's certainly where we put a lot of resources. I, on the other hand, am an old line programming language researcher down in the basement sort of doing programming languages. So, you know, my stuff will make programming easier, will make it easier for people to build the things that they build, but I wouldn't try to venture a guess as to how, through all the layers it has to go through before it gets to end users, what that will be like. But I think we'll be able to make much more flexible software. You guys, front one. Pardon? I think that's right. Hang on. Yeah, I think actually I don't know enough about that to give well, I'm not going to answer it, so I wasn't going to repeat it. So the question has to do with the connections between linguistic research and programming and programming language research. And I think that's an important question, and it's a technical enough area that I don't want to venture into it and say something silly. Yeah.
Going to be understanding.
So the question is, the question starts with an observation, which is that one of the reasons why multiple inheritance in object-oriented languages didn't get taken up is that it was difficult for people to understand how to use it, even people who could easily understand how to use single inheritance. And do we think we've done better with aspect-oriented programming? What's for sure is we need to do better. It's early days yet, so I don't think we're at a stage yet where you can teach thousands and thousands. I guess IDC says there's like 3 million Java programmers or something. You know, I don't think we could teach 3 million people how to use aspect-oriented programming tomorrow. On the other hand, in the project that I'm doing at Xerox, we do have an aspect-oriented extension to Java that seems to have the property that people pick it up and write good code with it almost right away. So I think we're in a potentially better spot. One of the things we're going to see in this work we're doing here with aspect-oriented implementation of operating system code is, you know, we're going to have to see, is that code more understandable? One of the tricky problems we're going to have is the same tricky problem that multiple inheritance had, which is you would rather not have a problem where you need to use this technology, right? It's a technology that's useful for very hard problems. And I think one of the ways that multiple inheritance got a bad rap was that all of the examples were really complicated. But that's because the examples were really complicated in part. But that's an issue we're going to have to work on. Oh, I don't know. I mean, so the question starts with an assertion that the code for human life is an elegant form of object-oriented programming, and then a question about whether it would be a good idea to teach biology in high school in parallel with programming because that would work better somehow. So, you know, I was going to try, early on in working on this talk, I was going to try to get something like this into it. And I decided not to, again, because, you know, particularly here, there's a lot of people who would know more about this than I, and I just didn't want to venture into a space where I'm not as expert. And then in particular, the question of, you know, how you push this back to high school education. We should talk about that. I'd like you to actually walk me through why it's object-oriented programming. That would be very interesting to hear. But I don't think we should talk about it now. I'm not going to be able to just stay in the basement with the technology, am I? The question has to do with program code as intellectual property and as a form of expression. You know, I mean, the whole intellectual property thing, I mean, there's legal issues, there's social issues, what's intellectual property, what's not. I think one thing is clear, which is that program code definitely counts as an expression of intellectual understanding and engineering achievement. I mean, one of the things I like to say is my goal is to let you write programs that look like their design, that truly capture something intellectual that you understand about the domain. So if you're willing to consider that things like that could be intellectual property, then I think you'd have to put programs in that. And then it's sort of more of a political question as to where you come down on that. I don't know, I worked for 15 years in a company, so I believed one way. I've been in a university now for a year. Maybe I'll switch another way. Oh, you had one. Didn't you have one, actually? Let's go over here. I don't know. The question is, which language is more aspect-oriented, English or Latin? It's been a long time since high school, and I only took 1 year of Latin. So let me. I will take a stab at this because you see, it seems to me that natural language has model-like properties, right? It quite clearly has model-like properties. Usually not formal model-like properties, but abstract model-like properties. And therefore, it's very easy to get cross-cutting in natural languages. I can say things like, read the next paragraph quickly. And then I can read the next paragraph. And it applies to the whole next paragraph, in a sense. So I can get cross-cutting, but I can't get this kind of cross-cutting, where there's a real sort of tight sense of what it means, the kind of cross-cutting you have there. And natural languages aren't effective in the way that programs are effective, by which I mean they don't have this property that they run. So I'm going to dodge your question entirely by saying that no natural language is aspect-oriented, because what aspect-oriented programming has to be is it has to be about programs that can really run. Yes, no? I think you could definitely do that. It's a bit outside of the program, but English sentences don't run. Yeah. Yeah. Right, so the question has to do with the fact that if you look at Moore's law, and you just extrapolate that out, more and more we're getting bigger and faster machines and more memory and more power and stuff like that. And how does that fit into the research that we're thinking about? Actually, it's interesting. In a funny way, because of ubiquitous computing, one of the things that's happening right now is we're taking a dramatic step backwards in terms of computing power, in terms of size of memory available, in terms of horsepower, right? Because these handheld devices have less power on board. There's a whole bunch of research in software engineering now on product line architectures and other kinds of ways for taking and modularizing your system down to a given application. And one of the things that people, we're not doing this, but one of the things that some people are trying to do with aspect-oriented programming is to get that kind of modularization in their systems so that they can deal with issues of taking a complex piece of software and giving you just the version you need on this handheld device. So in that sense, we are thinking about it, because I think aspect-oriented programming has some real applicability there. Those are very context-dependent applications. I think in another sense, we're depending on it because, you know, my other work that's in Java, right? We're just figuring Java will get fast someday. Yeah, go ahead.
This is an engineering problem. I'm not an engineer. Think of a road surface convex, straight on both sides. It approaches a curve, and you begin to get a concave shape. That's a factor of speed distance. Are we in object-oriented program?
I'll repeat the question slowly to give me time to think about it. So we've got a road surface, concave, convex at first. We get to a corner, it becomes more concave so that you won't kind of go flying off. And is that object-oriented or aspect-oriented? You know, that's going to have to get I don't know too. This analogy I have about the bridge is about as far as I can go in analogies. Let's do it after. Go ahead.
What progress do you see in programming as assisting programmers in debugging?
What progress do we see in assisting programmers in debugging? Well, you know, we do tremendously better than we used to. That's one thing I maybe didn't say is, you know, it's real easy to talk about what we don't do and how programming could be better. Stuff like object-oriented programming has brought us a tremendous way, right? People can build these amazing systems now that really only a few people could build 15 years ago. In terms of helping people with debugging, one of the things that I learned from, I think one of the computer scientists I learned the most from ever, a guy named Hal Abelson, is that the way you debug code is that you architect the code in the first place so that you can quickly decide that there's many possible things that are not wrong and begin to focus. Because his theory was that in the end, you're going to get down to those print statements. The question is, how many of them are you going to have to put in? So I think that things like object-oriented programming, things like aspect-oriented programming, anything that adds structure, it gives you this property of being able to rule off large parts of the space. Because in object-oriented programming, you can kind of say, well, you know, if this is this kind of menu, then it can't have anything to do with that kind of menu, to some extent anyways. So I think we're going to keep making the kind of progress we've been making, which is that structure helps you understand your program. I don't know of a great other breakthrough there coming. One last one, is that it?
It's right there.
That one?
Yes.
Okay. My capsule one message, my one-line summary that's going to be applicable to people who know nothing about computers all the way up to brilliant computer scientists. If you ever give a talk here, use up all the time before you get to the questions.
Professor Robert Woodham, professor and head of the UBC Computer
coffee and cookies outside.
Well, thank you. My specific task is to thank Gregor for the talk. I would like to express my thanks in a slightly broader context. Gregor has been now at UBC, as he mentioned, for slightly over a year. He came in January, year 2000. And bringing a senior researcher to UBC of Gregor's caliber requires a huge amount of effort by a large number of people. It's not an ordinary event. I won't thank those individuals by name, but I want to specifically acknowledge the role that NSERC, Natural Sciences Engineering Research Council, played, that Xerox played, and Sierra Systems Group, a local company, played in collectively recognizing the importance of this problem area to UBC, to BC, to Canada, in fact, to the world, and of the value of bringing Gregor to UBC. So he's been here for about a year. What I expected from someone like Gregor was that he would be a magnet who would be able to attract students at the undergraduate level, to attract graduate students, to be able to articulate vision, importance to the local community in terms of industry, government, we haven't hit you for government yet, and to the general public. And in all those things, I think Gregor so far has been a great success. And this is a difficult audience to speak to about these issues. I hope all of you saw some element of poetry, maybe even saw some element of gears, and maybe a little bit of the magic. So I actually like the term software architecture. I like the analogy to architecture. Because when we see a building or when we see a bridge, there is a clear aesthetic component and there is a clear functional component. And good architecture is when those things work together. And good software is when those things work together. And I'm proud of Gregor. I'm proud that he's here at UBC. I'm proud that he's in my department, because we have students who are not catching up with the architectures of the past, but we have students who are co-creating the architectures of the future, and that can only serve us all, in my view, very well. So that's my thank you, Gregor, both in general and specifically for the talk.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Paul.